How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvers and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio. It is September 29th, 2011, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. We are joined today by Jerry Jarrett. So much stuff to talk about today, including the Memphis Heat DVD, which is coming out on Saturday. And Jerry's got a new book out as well. It's called The Best of Times with Mark James, co-author. It is available right now at Amazon.com. You can head up there and check it out. We'll talk about other ways to get a hold of that book as well, but it's definitely up there at Amazon. And Jerry, how you doing today?
Good. Had a minor crisis, but I've worked through it, and I'm okay now.
Perfect. Now, I have not had a chance to see Memphis Heat yet, but it's available Saturday, everybody. And Dave has seen it, and he cannot stop talking about it. So, Dave, how awesome was this DVD?
Oh, I mean, you got to remember that in the 80s, when I first got my VCR, one of the first things that I did was trade tapes. And you know, the Memphis tapes were, you know, the Memphis live television was one of the best television shows in the country. And I just loved watching that stuff back in those days. And the DVD was just like, reminded me of it because it was, you know, it was very different from wrestling anywhere else in the country. Some people would say that was a negative. I thought it was a positive. I loved the style. I loved, you know, Lance Russell was a great announcer. You know, Jerry will talk about this, I'm sure. But, you know, people who, like, think that they know what Jerry Lawler is from watching WWF, it's just, you just don't have a grasp of what a talented interview this guy was. He was the epitome of a guy who every week would talk you into the seats. I mean, as good as anyone there ever was. And I was watching that, and I saw Jerry's all over the DVD. And it's like, I got to talk to Jerry Jarrett. I haven't talked to him in so many years. It's ridiculous. And anyway, that's but it's you know, it talks about, you know, the, you know, that era of wrestling from the late 50s with Sputnik and Rowan Billy Wicks through. The DVD goes through about the mid-80s when the Andy Kaufman feud and Jimmy Hart leaving, and for whatever reason, that's when they ended the DVD. I mean, you know, Memphis wrestling went on for, you know, till the late 90s, but that was the time period, and it's kind of like the glory days of the business in that city.
Jerry, what were your thoughts? Go ahead, Jerry. What were your thoughts when you watched the DVD?
Well, I was absolutely amazed that the producers, in my opinion, were able to capture the spirit, the magic, whatever you want to call it, that we had during those days. And, I mean, you know, to see the Mid-South Coliseum, which is on the verge of being torn down, with the big crowds there and all the talent that was so much a part of my life, it was really... It was an emotional event for me when I heard the our Memphis theme and saw the statue revolving. It was emotional.
What was you went to at least one of the openings? I don't know if you went to more, but I mean, what was it like in the theater? Because I'm figuring that there's, you know, the thing that I remember about Memphis wrestling is that from that Saturday morning show, Saturday morning 90-minute show, is that the city basically stopped when your TV was on. And, I mean, no one can, you could tell the numbers, and you can't even fathom it. It's a different era anyway. I mean, it's like, you know, you didn't have that many TV stations. Even saying that, you know, you were bigger than any primetime television show. You were probably bigger than, you know, anything but the Super Bowl. They would preempt major sports events on the NBC affiliate because they weren't going to preempt your show. I mean, it's just amazing in hindsight how big wrestling was in that city. And I mean, is there any secret to that? What would you say the factors were that made that?
Well, first, to go back, one thing that was funny, it wasn't funny. We got a higher rating than the 5 and 6 o'clock news. So, you know, ratings influence the cost of a commercial spot. And so we were a big revenue source for the station. The the uniqueness, I think, of Memphis wrestling was that, you know, I'd like to take a big share of the credit, but in all fairness, what I basically did is allowed the talent a stage and didn't overproduce, didn't interfere too much. Every wrestler that is a main event headline wrestler can produce himself better than anybody else can produce him. So I recognize this because of my own wrestling career. And so I let Lawler produce Lawler and Dundee produce Dundee, and I just kind of served as a referee if somebody would be a little greedy and want to take too much of the glory. But otherwise, I really let the talent have their way. And I think in those days this was really a unique promoting style. I was able to carry that same style to Atlanta when Jim Barnett hired me, and Bill Watts was there before me, and Bill is I don't know what to say, maybe military...
dictator.
Yes, okay. In other words, he really, really produces every phase of it. Now, Bill is brilliant, and he, in his own right, is one of the more successful promoters of all time. However, when he was in Atlanta, he didn't have the history, and he over-promoted and restricted the guys, and they were, you know, they wasn't drawing anything. So when I went down, I called some of my buddies. I called Lou Thesz, I called Terry Garvin, and I said, wouldn't it be exciting if this gay guy slapped you, Lou, and then faked a heart attack? And he said, I got it. It's great. And they did the rest of it. And you know, sold out the old auditorium. My style, Dave, was to... I raised horses, and a good horse, you can give him his head. A bad horse, you have to rein him in or he'll go to acting crazy. I had some good horses, and I gave them their head. It's that simple.
Now, in the style and everything like that, you know, you did a lot of angles that in many ways are similar to now, but at the same time, and I know, like, I noticed it from your comments that there's a... And one of the things I thought that was really interesting, because we're talking the 1970s and the 80s, and especially you're talking about, like, when if you would sell out the Coliseum, which was about 11,000 people, that in your estimation, maybe 1,000 of those people believed that it was completely real, and the others were willing to suspend their disbelief. And that's, like, different from, you know, a lot of people think, oh, everyone in those days thought it was real. And I always thought it wasn't that they thought it was that they allowed themselves, because it was more fun to allow yourself to get into it like it's real. And it's never, and the key was never being slapped in the face while you were there, that it wasn't. And I thought that that was so simple, but it was, you know, especially now when I hear that, and it's like, wow, that's so simple, of such a simple philosophy, and I think that was a lot of what the fun of wrestling was in that era.
Right. I've had people that were in high positions of writing, producing television, to say to me, "What difference does it make? Everybody knows that it's not real," and I'm just astounded at this attitude, and it falls on, my response falls on deaf ears when I would say, so is good theater. So is good, great movies, great television. What you're doing is paramount to letting somebody watch an hour and a half movie, and when they're in the last scene and they've been stalking this person, and in the last scene the camera pulls back and you see lights and makeup people and technicians, and then you scroll across the bottom of the screen, oh yeah, don't forget, this is not real. Well, you know, you would be irate. I would be, if I'd paid my money to go see a movie. So what I wanted to do was allow the people for the 2 hours that they were, or the 2.5 hours that they were at the Coliseum, or the hour and a half that they were watching Memphis television, to watch it as if it's a movie, and if the, so that they can get emotionally involved and pretend in their own mind that it's real. And you know, I was different people. Now that I've gotten out of the business, different wrestlers will say, do you know what kind of terror you were if you caught a heel and a babyface riding together? I've seen you fire people for when the guy didn't have another ride. And I would say, and it is because you are cheating the fan that's paying his money when you're having this bloody battle with the guy, and go out and get in his car. So, you know, I really believed in some of those things. And all of my philosophy is based on the years that I was a fan sitting at the Hippodrome. You know, I booked and promoted what I enjoyed watching. And sometime it was Nick Gula's promotion, and sometime it was just atrocious and it would make me angry. And other times it was great.
You know, when you go through, you know, it's interesting because, again, like I'm reading your book, and I didn't realize that you actually were involved in. I knew that your mother was, you know, worked in the wrestling office in Rand Cities. I didn't know that you had been in the business that young, but I remember my first memory was Jerry Jarrett and Tojo Yamamoto, you know, wrestling, and I didn't know exactly when the booking started and how it started, and that was very interesting in and of itself. You know, you talked about the split with Nick Gulas, and I mean it's just kind of interesting in the sense that he basically screwed you out of $50,000, and or else, you know, you could have probably worked with him for the next 10 years, and you know, his insistence on pushing his son, I guess, would that be accurate?
Yeah, and it was very sad because, you know, Nick and I were really, really close. But Nick found it out, I found it out, most parents find it out sooner or later. You can absolutely love your children far, far too much. And when you do that, when you cross that line, it's disastrous for you and for your children. And Nick just loved George so much that he wore blinders when it came to George's talent and his ability, and he ran the Birmingham Inn down to where it was losing a lot of money, and fortunately we were having such great business in Memphis and Louisville and Evansville and Lexington that we were able to pay the losses for Nick's Inn and still all of us live better than we deserved. But then when Nick came in and wanted me to take George to Memphis, I just flat refused. And so he, in effect, fired me. And, of course, I didn't think he could fire me, but I thought I owned a part of the business, and I didn't. And that was my stupidity. I just, you know, I was young and had never done business, and I didn't know about options, and I didn't even read the contract. I figured, you know, this is, they really like me. I'm making them a lot of money. But I was wrong.
Now, in going against them, I mean, and another thing I thought, what was it like, you know, I mean, two of the guys that were your biggest stars and your friends were Jackie Fargo and Tojo Yamamoto, who was the tag team partner and helped you get started as a wrestler. And they stayed with Nick, you know, and Lawler was the guy who went with you. I mean, especially, I guess, Tojo, just because from the book it sounded like you were very close friends and you had the business relationship, you know, going way back. And then when push came to shove, especially when your side of the territory was the one making money and Memphis was the hottest city, that they stayed with Gulas, who, I mean, Tojo's, you know, passed away a long time ago, but Fargo, you know, in that movie basically said that he hated Gulas or, you know, didn't trust him or whatever.
Right. But, Dave, I don't know. I have, you know, I'll die not knowing now. Tojo, I brought him back in and, you know, told him he had a job as long as he wanted one. And I asked him why, and he said, I don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? He said, I guess I didn't think you would make it. And I said, you rode up and down the road, you and Fargo, and told me, why do you give Nick Gulas and Roy Welch half of all this money you're making? And I said, you know, my answer was it's the right thing to do. Then when Nick double-crossed me and gave me a green light to, you know, open up my own company, they didn't come, and I'll never know. Everybody in the territory that I was booking, and I'd say half of the people that were on the Birmingham end that Nick was booking, offered to come with me and work for me, except Tojo and Fargo. And I really, you know, I don't know. I'm sure I'll die not knowing.
Do you think, what would have happened if Lawler had gone the other way? I mean, do you ever think about, like if he had stayed with Nick, would Nick have survived, or would George have basically ruined it for Nick within a few years, or do you think you could have gone without Lawler and created your own, another Lawler, so to speak?
No, when Roy gave me the book in Memphis, the company was teetering on going out of business. They were, I don't know, $50,000 in debt to the bank, and you got to remember the time. That was a lot of money back then. And, you know, if you don't have $10 and you owe it, you're bankrupt. But, you know, they were not doing very good. I do not know. My answer is I don't think they would have made it. My answer about Lawler is I've told the world he is the best talent I ever produced or worked with, and the worst businessman. I think that, you know, there were a lot of people. If you go back to that era, Mark James documents the talent that we had. And, you know, just like with Vince McMahon, you know, Hogan left and Scott Hall left and everybody left. And it, the wrestling business, a successful territory, is bigger than any single wrestler, or for that matter, any dozen wrestlers. I just, you know, if it's successful, if the formula is successful, it's successful as long as you have talented wrestlers. You can't do it with a bunch of jabronis, but there's an amazing amount of talent on the independent circuit right now that will probably, some of them, unfortunately, will never see the bright lights. And I see them in the ring if I go to a little independent show, and I'm thinking, damn, I wish I had him in Memphis.
You know, one of the things I just, when you were talking, it just reminded me, and it was a conversation that you and I had. We're talking in the mid '90s, early '90s, and you had mentioned, and this is when Vince, you know, thought that Hogan and Savage were too old, and they both ended up going to WCW, and you were the one who said that, like, you know, like, I think he thought that, you know, he had gotten all the mileage he could out of those two guys. And you had told him something to the effect of, they were on your TV for years and years, and there's plenty of mileage left in them. And that actually, you know, they were two of the catalysts in giving Vince, you know, the real big fight of his life a few years later. And
And, you know, that's just a judgment call. If I had been running WWE, I would have tried to give them more longevity. Vince didn't. They had a good run at Turner, and the story. Vince survived, and Turner didn't.
Now, going to that, because we talked before about during that period, 2000-ish, when Turner was going down, and you were in the middle of a lot of different things. I know you were talking with everybody, and there was always talk of you trying to put together something to buy the company. And there were other people who I knew, you know, who had came to me and said that they were looking at, you know, buying the company. And somehow, and I don't know what the story is, and you probably being firsthand might know better. What was the deal as far as, you know, how that all went down with, you know, Vince, not so much Vince getting it, because by then they'd canceled the TV, but what was the mindset of the people at Turner? Because I know they wanted out of the business. There were plenty of people who wanted to take it over, just because as long as it was still on TV, you know, if you did it right, you could make money. I mean, what do you remember about that period?
They sent us the last 5 years' financials for the company. And, let me go explain to you who us was. John Corcoran is the founder and owner of Trinity Partners in Boston. And he represented a bank that represented Vern Gagne when I was trying to buy Vern's business. Vern owed the bank a lot of money, so the bank had to be in on if he got rid of any assets. During those negotiations, John Corcoran and I became good friends, because John left Minneapolis because he felt like that Vern was not dealing, I won't say not fairly. Vern, it's the same thing, loving your son too much. We had a deal and went to the lawyers and worked every part of it out, and Vern was gracious enough to have me staying at his house. And the morning that we were to go to the lawyer's office and sign everything, Vern comes to me in the kitchen and says, "You think good on your feet, Jerry, and I don't. But last night when I laid down, what I realized is we haven't addressed Greg." And I said, "Well, what do you want to address?" He said, "I want you to, let's go to the office, and I've called Greg, and he's going to meet you there, and y'all talk." Anyway, that conversation was a disaster, and John Corcoran went home, and I went home. From that situation in Minneapolis, John Corcoran and I stayed good friends. So some investor people that knew the AOL, Time Warner, Turner situation, I don't know how inside, but they, you know, John seemed to know they were going to sell it before anybody else did. John put together a group of investors that made a $70 million offer in my name for WCW. It, part of the conditions were that they, you know, the disclosure period of a negotiation, they send you the financials. The day that WCW closed up, they had a $125 million annual revenue stream and were losing money. So Corcoran sent me one, he reduced these reams of documents to one or two sheets, and he sent it to me, and he said, how can you make this make money? So I looked it all over, and I said, well, first thing you do is you fire everybody that works there, and I mean everybody. And then at the end of the meeting that you've terminated everybody, and tell them we'll spend the money if you want to fight it, but you're overpaid and you're fired. And but I'm going to be, when this room clears out, I'm going to be here, and having a wrestling company, I'll need to hire people. And I was going to hire everybody and get them off of the $1 million. There were 16 of them that were guaranteed $1 million. Conan got paid for, I think, 2 years and didn't wrestle. I mean, it was insane. So I told John, basically, after looking, knowing you could cut this and cut that, and predicated on keeping the sales, the cash flow coming, I think maybe I factored a 10 or 15% drop in income. We could have made like $20 million the first year. And so then he's tendered the offer, and he never got an answer. He never got a response at all. Now, at the same time, Eric Bischoff was trying to put together a group, and that fell through. And, you know, there's been a lot written about it that said, well, Turner decided they didn't want programming. Well, and you're as close to this business, the heartbeat of the actual business, as anybody. As strong as WCW was, what a 3 rating, I wasn't at all worried that I couldn't place it on a network. And so that was not really that relevant a fact to me whether, you know, we stayed on Turner on TBS or not. And, well, Vince ended up buying the company, and I've heard all different numbers. But
it wasn't $70
million. Huh?
It wasn't $70 million, that's for sure.
Oh, no, I think it was $3-5 million.
The $2.5 million, and then like promise of maybe $2 more million in advertising type of money. So yeah, that was the range.
Something like that. That's,
yeah.
I mean, I've heard several times, and it's all between $2 and $5 million.
Yeah.
There was an interesting development during that time for all of your conspiracy theorists out there, of which I don't happen to be one. Siegel's right-hand man left Turner and went to work for WWE. And between 3 and 6 months after Vince bought it, the executive that was at WWE quit. I mean, that was at WCW, quit WWE.
Mm. So, when the wrestling business changed in the mid '80s, when Vince went national, I mean, at what point did you think that, you know, the territorial business was going to change, and you know, eventually, you know, most of them went out, and it, you know, it took you longer than most, but you ended up going out to a decade or so later. But I mean, did you notice it? Because as I recall, the first couple of years, you know, Vince went out in 84, and 84, 85, you know, and even after that, for a couple, 84 and 85 were big years for you, and you still did well for several more years after that. And a lot of people did well in 84 and 85, and then by 86, a lot of the companies started having a lot of trouble. I mean, at what point in that game did you sort of see that, you know, my life is changing, and you know, what you know, and then it was kind of like, okay, then what do I do now type of thing, you know, with life, so to speak?
Well, you know, I don't know if I played ostrich and stuck my head in the sand, you know. When you reflect back on a period of life, it's really hard to recall exactly what you were thinking. I'm sure there was a time that I said, you know, we can keep on keeping on, and if you're making $1.5 million a year, $1 million isn't bad, so I can lose a third of my business. Or, well, if I'm making $1 million, $750,000 is not bad. And if I'm, you know, each stage you tell yourself, and then finally it got down to the point where I said, you know, I can make $250,000 doing something else. And that's the time that I said, you know, the famous lines of Gone with the Wind, it is a time that is no more.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's when I had a construction company, and I just decided to apply all my energies into the development business and sell to Lawler.
Now, one of the famous periods in your company history was when the Poffos were running against you. And it's kind of been romanticized, but I know when it was actually going on, it was a very heated thing, you know, with them calling you out personally, calling out Lawler, you know, Bill Dundee, all your stars on their TV constantly. And, I mean, when the... You know, what was it like? Because I know that from talking to the guys who worked for you, you know, there's a natural impulse of whether it's to address it in some form or talk back or fight them or whatever. I mean, everyone, I'm sure, had different ideas. And you were strict on this one, because everyone who's ever brought this up to me said, Jarrett says we do not address it. We're not going to talk about it. We ignore it. And basically you did. How hard was it to keep everyone in line when they were doing that? And also, when the time came, you know, and they were done, and Papos wanted to come to work for you, at that point, I mean, how hard was it when they badmouthed you all those years, weighing the fact that certainly coming in, you had a ready-made big-time angle?
Yeah, well, it never was a heated situation with me personally. Never. By that time of my life, I'd been through some really serious stuff with, Galento, and there's no question in my mind he tried to kill me. The situation with Roy, he had dementia or Alzheimer's or something, and they were some pretty scary times. So by the time the Papo thing came along, I said, long before Donald Trump said it, I said, well, it's just business. We live in America, and they have a right to try to carve them out a niche. Now, they're not very smart business-wise, because they're trying to carve out one of the most, a piece of one of the most successful territories in the nation. Why don't you go south and toward Birmingham? And Birmingham, Huntsville, and I didn't say that to them. I just said it to myself. Remember when we started this, my style was never dictatorial. So I didn't demand that the wrestlers not accept any challenge or talk about it. I told them we're not going to do that on my television. But instead, I would sit down and give them the logic, the soundness of my logic, and saying, why do we want to waste one moment of our breath giving credibility to somebody that's not even on the radar with the fans? Most people don't know they exist. Their ratings on television are horrendous. It just doesn't make any sense. Now, wrestlers have vanity, and my balls are bigger than yours, and I'm tougher than you are. And so some of the boys wanted to, call the Papos out on that. But it didn't take much conversation for them to say, you're right, we're not going to say anything. Now, at the end of it, when they folded up, they had spent a year what the fans perceived was working an angle. And so I just said, when they called me, Randy called me to say, I hope you didn't take any personal offense to this. I was just, my family and I were trying to go in business, and this is where we tried to do it. And I said, no, Randy, why don't we work the angle? This is a little sidebar that's interesting. Lawler Jerry Lawler does not have a reputation of being a tough guy. But I can tell you that he hit like a mule. I've seen him in riots knock out 8 people in the ring. And I'm talking about Stone Cold out with 8 punches. As granted, they're fans, but I knew that Lawler was not worried about Randy, whether Randy was for real or not for real. And so I said, why don't you? And I called Lawler after he said, you know, man, that would be wonderful. And told him, and Jerry said, that's great. I think we can make some money off it. Because a few people do know about the challenges. So we, you know, and it turned out Randy, bless his heart, he's gone now, but he was turned out to be the most honorable wrestler I was ever around. He's the only one that told Vince McMahon, I have to give Jerry a notice, and if I can't, I can't come. And Randy didn't tell me that. Vince McMahon told me that.
When in that period, in that angle actually was one of my favorite angles. When Randy and his father, I think, whatever it was, I don't know if Lanny was there or not. I don't remember off the top of my head. But Randy, I remember coming onto your TV, and I mean the mentality of that. I mean, it's like I always hearken back to that today. Whenever they try to do a, you know, someone from another company coming in or someone debuting and trying to make it look real, and how it just never can touch the way, you know, it's like you did it in the way that was plausible, and everyone else does it like, oh, here it's, you know, like almost like here it's real. It's almost like the way they push it is almost like telling you that this is just part of the show. I mean, how were you mentally when it comes to booking something where you wanted people, again, to think this isn't part of the show? Even though it really was part of the show.
I can tell by your question, you're really not buying the part that I wasn't as brilliant as some people have said I was. What I told Randy was, Randy said, how do you want to do this thing? I said, I want you to do whatever you would do if it's real. I said, now, if that would entail you jumping in the ring, I don't want you to punch Lawler or whoever you punch for real. But if whatever you would do, if you finally out of frustration said, damn it, I'm going to their TV. And he said, okay, I got you. And so Lawler said, what are we going to do? And I said, I don't know. We'll play it by ear. And that's how it came off so real. We didn't know what was going to happen. See, it goes back to what I'm saying. You know, I love Vince and Linda, but their product is way, way overproduced. And I won't even go to TNA.
I want to ask you a couple of... Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Brian.
You can't be successful and overproduce the wrestling business because the wrestlers are really atrocious actors. They're horrible. When Dusty Rhodes can play Dusty Rhodes, if you ask Dusty Rhodes to play The Rock, he would come across as the phoniest person in the world. The Rock can play The Rock. Now, he happens to also be able to play different characters, but he doesn't stray far, if you watch his movies, from playing The Rock. And you know, Hogan plays Hogan, and Jerry Lawler is the king, still. And wrestlers, you can't ask them to act. They're terrible. they're not very good at.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your thoughts on the business today. I was actually going to ask you about that right there, your comment early about giving a horse its head. It's funny that you mentioned that, and when people ask, you know, what was your secret to booking, and you talk about, oh, it wasn't really a secret, I just let these guys be themselves. And it's funny because today, I mean, it's exactly the opposite of what they do, especially in WWE. I mean, it's everybody is given a character, everybody's given some sort of gimmick, everybody has their scripts written for them. It's a totally different business, and you talked about that a little bit, and I also wanted to ask you about the other thing you talked about, you know, you promoted a product that was similar to what you enjoyed growing up, and you learned from the good and the bad of what you saw growing up, and I just think about it nowadays, and you know, anybody growing up past about
people growing up now, it's scary.
Yeah, people growing up past about 1998. I mean, there's a lot of Vince Russo. There's a lot of title changes. I mean, it's a very scary proposition to think 10 years down the road. You know, the future bookers and the stuff that they grew up on. It's nothing like it was when it was wildly successful on a regional level, and when you actually had to make money to stay in business.
Yeah, all I can do is hope. Now, I will say this. The WWE, and the reason I am a little novice, I guess you'd say, as a fan, is that I have grandchildren who are huge WWE fans. We carried them to Memphis. WWE had a house show down there, and they got to meet John Cena and Lawler and in the back, and they were just beside themselves. And they will grow up with fond memories of this wrestling because they don't know what you and I are exposed to. They don't know that storytelling, emotional investment of the wrestling business of yesterday. So what I'm saying is, Jarrett, my grandson, my oldest grandson, he'll have fond memories of watching John Cena hold up four fingers or, you know, whatever his little gimmick is. And you know, John Cena movies, and he'll love that.
Now, without the storylines and the booking and everything that made wrestling successful many years ago, do you believe that as he grows up, he will continue to be a fan? Because it was a different business when kids watched something. And, you know, a lot of my friends when I was a kid, you know, they became fans when Randy Savage dropped the ring bell on Ricky Steamboat's neck. And they'll never forget that storyline. And, you know, storylines today, they're nothing like that. Someone gets beat up every week. There's no follow-up. I mean, are these kids going to stay invested in wrestling as they get older?
I don't think so. I think it'll be like, do you remember the Ninja Turtles?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
They were hotter than a firecracker, and I can remember looking for them in three or four states because I waited too long to get Ninja Turtles for Christmas for my children. And today, you say Ninja Turtle, and they go, what? So, I mean, you know, it's, I think that the answer to your question is no. I don't think there will be lifelong fans like they are today. I have on Facebook 5,000 Facebook friends. Now, I'm 69 years old. Think about that for a minute. All these people watched wrestling, and it was a part of their life, and they loved it, and they're appreciative. So will somebody come up and start developing storylines, maybe, and, you know, challenge the WWE dominance? I get about a call a month. Would you be interested in the getting back in the wrestling business? And my answer is, if you can show me that you have 10 or 20 million, the answer is yes. Otherwise, the answer is no. I've been there. I know what running out of money will do. So, somebody may call somebody and say, Dave Meltzer, you want to open up a wrestling company like traditional wrestling was? That could happen. There are a lot of people with a lot of money. If they don't, I think they'll keep, WWE will survive regardless, and they'll keep making new fans out of the children.
One of the things that is interesting to me as far as the creative end was, and when you booked, and you know, it wasn't like you booked, you know, 20 years straight or whatever it was. I mean, you would book a few months, and maybe Dundee would book or Lawler would book. You know, you would rotate.
Right.
And now they basically have teams, and I mean, like in WWE, they have teams in the sense that they have the same people on booking 52 weeks a year. The underlings get fired left and right, but the top people are the same top people that were there 7-10 years ago, straight every single week, doing all, you know, not just 90 minutes of TV. They're doing 5 hours or whatever it is of TV every single week, 8 hours with a pay-per-view. In TNA, it's the same basic two guys that have done it for, you know, years and years and years. I mean, was there a reason? You were running the company. What was your reason as far as, like, saying, okay, you know, I'm not going to book for 6 months? You know, I mean, did you recognize that there's the burnout factor? Or what's the basic story on that?
No, the absolute truth of it is that I got into the wrestling business and just started making a whole lot of money. And I was raised poor, and you remember the beer commercial that said, live with all the gusto you can?
Yeah.
That was my attitude. I bought a fabulous house in Sanibel Island. If you're familiar with that, it's an expensive place. And so a house on the water cost an obscene amount of money. And I loved that place. I loved my boat. I loved fishing. And so I would, whenever we would have things really rocking and rolling, that's when I would decide, well, I'll take a rest and go to Florida. And that's what I did. It wasn't any master plan. It wasn't any logic. It was just that I wanted to play.
I got one more question here, then I'll let Dave do his final questions. This is in regards to something you said about the end of WCW, and if you had gone in and bought the company, you would have sat everybody down and had the meeting. You're all fired, but I'm going to need some talent, so come back in when we're done, and I'll hire some of you back. You, of course, founder of TNA. It's been almost 10 years. It's not the place it was when you envisioned it starting out, and it's quite frankly, a really sad place right now. And if, for example, the opportunity came for you to go back in there, I mean, is this also a situation where you've got to fire everybody, you've got to get rid of everything, you've got to change all the colors, like a complete and total revamp? I don't even know how much you watch the show nowadays. Or is it something where if you just got certain people out of creative, it could be kind of overhauled right now?
All right. From the talent standpoint, because of the adult theme and profanity, me and my children, we don't allow our children to watch TNA. And so I can't, therefore I don't watch it. I can't judge that. I know from back when I did watch it that I would, of course, fire Russo and everybody associated with that style of booking. The other thing I would do is, I'm too old, I don't have the energy, but I would find a booker that had a passion, and I would sit him down and I would say, we are a goal-oriented company. You have 3 months to show me progress. If you don't, you're fired. Not 3 months to start making a lot of money, just to head in the right direction. And then I'd sit back and watch him. And if he did anything in those 3 months other than build talent, then, you know, I might fire him early. But generally, you can't blame failure on the talent. You blame it on the head honcho. Now, the head honcho may not necessarily be the owner, but whoever calls the shots, whoever writes the television, whoever hires the talent. And, of course, I've never believed in committees. I wouldn't be on a committee to write a novel. I wouldn't be on a committee to write a theater play. I think that creative has to be the single vision of one mind. Now, can you have staff? I always had staff. I always had people to bounce ideas off of. I used all of my top talent as idea men. But somebody has to be the referee and say, this might be a good idea, but it's outside of my vision. It's outside of where I want to go. A program that I had that lasted for a year was Jerry Lawler's Quest for the Title. And so every time we would have a meeting with my staff, I would say, before you go throwing out ideas, ask, does this fit into the single vision of Lawler becoming the world heavyweight champion? And I hope that, listening to myself talk, it feels like I'm beating around the bush, but, you know, that's the only way I know how to answer you.
When was there anyone, if this comes to mind, where you saw them and you just said, this guy, you know, this guy doesn't have to be a wrestler and end up being a big star, or vice versa, somebody who came into your territory, maybe they were 20, 21 years old, and you said, like, wow, this guy's going to make a lot of money in the business, and for whatever reason got derailed. I mean, does anyone like fit into those kind of, categories?
No, I don't think so. I missed a lot. I had Ultimate Warrior and Sting in here, and I told both of them they needed to go back to California and get a real job, that they just, neither one of them would ever make any money in the business.
Yeah.
So.
But, I mean, when they came to you, I mean, they were, I remember when they came to you, it was like, they were giant bodybuilders, and they had hardly trained. I mean, they were the blind of the blind at that early stage when they first came.
And the same with Hulk Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, Sting and Warrior were both better wrestlers than Hogan. But with Hogan, I felt the charisma. And so when he had his run here, I first contacted my buddy Vince Sr., and he didn't want him, so I sent him to Vern. But, no, I mean, you know, Lawler, I knew when he was a kid chewing gum in his ring, in the ring in Memphis, and I had to scream at him. You know, I knew that he had the it factor. But I mean, you know, I'm sure I missed some. I saw Paul Orndorff. He was doing jobs for Eddie Graham, and I said, you know, this guy's a star. And so I brought him to Memphis. I don't know. I mean, there's a bunch of them. I don't think that I ever felt it, and then they didn't turn out good.
Did you? I mean, one of the things that's very different. If you watch the DVD, it hits you right away. Is the type of the wrestling business had a much wider variety of characters back then. I mean, of unique individuals. You know, like just like a Joe LaDuke just pops into my head, just because. You know, he wasn't in your territory, or at least not in that I saw with like Mad Dog Vachon type of guys. That, you know, those type of people don't really exist in today's business. Everyone is kind of, I don't know, it's like they're all fit kind of from the same mold. And there's nothing against any of them, when you wanted a crew, I mean, was it your kind of your head, okay, I need someone to draw women, I need someone to draw ethnics, I need someone this and that, or did it just kind of happen that way, and like a wide variety of different type of heels? Did you kind of have that thing where you wanted a bunch of different type of guys in the territory, or was it just kind of like what was there at the time is what you did business with?
Yeah. No, I'm very opinionated on this line of conversation. I think that God made every human being unique. Every human being has talents. Every human being has faults and flaws. I think that in my giving the horse his head, I would tell like Jim Cornette, for example. My mother was real good friends with his mother, and she put pressure for me to bring Jimmy to Memphis to take pictures. So that was, you know, my exposure to him. And then when I brought him into the business, I told him, I said, Jimmy, the reason you are getting this chance is that you are a unique human being. I don't know if you're wealthy or poor, but you come across as a spoiled mama's boy. Are you? And he said, well, probably. I said, okay. Then what I want you to do is make the Jimmy Cornette character bigger than life. Just go out there and be yourself. So, I mean, you know what Cornette looks like. He would never be confused with being an athlete. But he became a great, great character in our business. Jimmy Hart is, I thought he was on speed most of his life. But he became a great character. Plowboy Frazier was a giant. The Fabs were movie star qualities. I just took what came my way. And I agree with you, it is sad that the worst thing in the world are these schools that clone all these people? I mean, you know, you got to be what, 6'3" and a 28-inch waist, and I mean, you know, they all look alike, and so you don't have the diversity. Somebody, I think, needs to sit and look out in the audience and say, you know, there's a great diversity in our fans. Maybe we ought to have more diversity in our talent.
You know, I want to ask you about that very quickly, because I've always kind of felt the same thing, that the wrestling business attracts, I don't want to say crazy people, but, you know, you talk about how everybody in the world is different and unique, but some people are more outgoing and bombastic and crazier than others. And wrestling seemed to always attract those kind of people. And I often wonder if, when you look at WWE today and you see the clones, they're all 6 feet tall, they all have short hair, they all are, you know, they're kind of encouraged to just sort of, you know, kind of like you said, be clones. It makes me kind of wonder, is that the future of this business where the crazy people, they're never featured on the show? You know, is it going to be a deal where the people that are attracted to this business are more tall, short-haired, rather generic, not as crazy people? That, to me, is not a good thing.
No, it isn't. And this didn't happen by accident. Vince, for whatever reason, has decided that he doesn't want wrestling people on the creative staff. So what he instead gets is non-wrestling people from Hollywood who are producing their stereotype of a wrestler. In other words, their vision of what a wrestler is supposed to look like. And, you know, I think that's sad.
And another follow-up there on that very quickly, I just wanted your opinion on this. I always have also felt that one of the things about wrestling is that these people are supposed to be larger than life. But in some ways, fans are supposed to live vicariously through these people. And I always kind of felt that, you know, like you said, fans are, they're different shapes, they're different sizes. You know, everybody's different. And I always saw a guy like Dusty Rhodes, you know, he doesn't have a great physique or anything like that. He's a hard-working guy, he's a little overweight, but goddamn, he's going in there and he's beating folks up. And I always kind of felt that's missing today. Where are the fat guys that a fat guy in the audience can go, you know, that guy is, you know, he's a big star, but
Roy Nelson.
A Roy Nelson, something like that. I mean, it just seems like you kind of want that, I would think.
Yep.
Someone for everybody.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir. I don't know. I hope that it goes. And you know, necessity is the mother of invention. That's an old cliche, and the reason it's old is it's true. And so, I don't follow it anywhere near like I used to. I'll get an email from an old wrestling friend, and they'll tell me, and I might go check online what the rating was. But from all that my perspective and what I hear, the ratings are trending down.
Slowly, but
is that true?
Yes, look, I think that the audience is pretty consistent, but it is slowly, it's slowly going down. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I don't mean anything radical, but it's, I remember when, what are the ratings now? I remember when Vince was close to a 5, 4, 7, and WCW was like a 4.
Yeah, that was in the, you know, Vince got up as high as the 6s. When WCW was really going down, and then after 01, it started dropping. You know, I think he was in the mid 5s, and you know, from that point on, then they went to the 4s, and now that it's football season, they're right below a 3. I think is where they're going to be. You know, 2.8, 2.9 through football season, and then they'll probably pop up to a 3, 3.1, 3.2 when the season's over. you know. And so that's
well.
And TNA is going to be 1-0 to 1-2 forever. You know.
Yeah, I think that Vince McMahon is a genius. I really do. And I think one day he will say, you know what? We need to go back to the future and radically change. Because, see, I've sat in his den and had a conversation very, very similar to what we're having right now. Now, that I'm sure that seems strange, but Vince would ask 1,000 questions about Memphis. And when he would come down there, you know, that's where I made the suggestion that he would be a great talent. And so we brought him to Memphis kind of as a test pattern. And he would come back and he would say, I've never seen passion like this. What causes this? And I said, you know, it's because the people are emotionally invested. So I think one day Vince will wake up and say, here's what's missing. I really do. And if he doesn't do it, and it probably won't be till after he's dead and gone, somebody that has $50 million will decide to open a wrestling company and do it where the people can get emotionally involved. And if that happens, the WWE will be in trouble and TNA will be defunct.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, you were there in the early days of TNA. I always thought that there were moments where they were headed in a good direction, but they weren't consistent, and then they just, you know, at one point just kind of lost their way, and I'm not, you know, I just sense that, you know, people there right now, you know, they're just kind of there, you know, they're there for, I don't want to say they're there for a paycheck, but they kind of, I think that what I would say is they've accepted their lot. I think that at one point in TNA, there were five people going like, you know, when some of the wrestlers were younger, it's like, you know, we'll outwork those guys. And, you know, not to say that they'll beat Vince. I don't know that anyone ever thought that. But that we'll, you know, like the idea of like we'll slowly build this rating up to a 2 or something like that. And now I think that the thing is just like it is what it is. And you know, I don't sense the passion from anyone in that company as far as, yeah, we're just on the right track and we're about to turn it around and this angle is going to really be the one. It's just sort of like this is where we are and we'll just keep going and do exactly what we do, you know, every week, and it's the same, you know, same thing, you know, stay in the same ballpark, whether that's good or bad, they're still in business type of thing. I mean, when you were there at the beginning, I mean, what was your goal since you were, you know, part founder of the thing, and then where do you think that it lost its like the wheel steered off the ship, so to off the train?
My goal was to recapture the 3 rating number of fans that WCW that went away. If you remember, Vince bought them out, hit I think a 7. 2 weeks later was back to his original rating, and nobody knew where the WCW fans went to, but they went away. My goal was to recapture that with traditional wrestling. I did not want Jeff to be like other promoters' sons. And so I deferred to him from the very beginning. What I didn't know, and it was, you know, it was an emotional, traumatic thing for our family. I didn't know that I was in his right ear and Vince Russo was in his left ear before our first match during the planning stages. So what you see in the changing horses, changing directions, is you see these two influences. My influence was the low-key, I didn't like the name X Division, but the X Division style, with wrestlers, and heavy emphasis on the in-ring activity. Vince Russo wanted to, you know, write every move and have a lot of silly stuff, the dups, and he had a dup cup. You know, stuff that really embarrassed me, and I thought, you know, I would sit down to Jeff and I'd say, Jeff, you were there. You watched Memphis. You saw the success. Why would you change from that? And well, Dad, it's a different time. And it finally got so that I just couldn't take it anymore, so I did my swan song and exited.
Now, your book, The Best of Times, is available on Amazon.com. You also wrote a book about the development of TNA, and I know that book is available as well, so I want to give you a chance to talk about where else these books can be purchased besides Amazon.com.
On JerryJarrett.com. And just type in JerryJarrett.com, and Mark James set the website up, and you can order a regular copy or an autographed copy. And you know, if you're a fan of Memphis wrestling, my life, I didn't mean for it to be a wrestling book. I meant for it to chronicle my life as well as I could for my grandchildren. But of course my life parallels the wrestling business for at least 50 years of it.
Two books, Jerry Jarrett's Story, The Best of Times, Jerry Jarrett with Mark Jones. That is up available at Amazon.
Mark James.
Up at Amazon.com. Also, JerryJarrett.com, MemphisWrestlingHistory.com. The other book, The Story of the Development of the NWA TNA. That's available on JerryJarrett.com as well. And this Saturday, Memphis Heat is out on DVD. You can check that out at MemphisHeatTheMovie.com. There's a bunch of YouTube videos up there, a bunch of previews. And Jerry, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and best of luck with all of the books and everything else you've been doing.
I certainly appreciate it, and I thank you for the opportunity to hawk my book.
And, of course, thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you again later on tonight.